Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
Dharma, incomparable, profound, minutely subtle, revealing right here, right now. Yet it is rarely met with, even in hundreds, thousands, millions of eons. We can see this, listen to this, accept and hold this. May we completely understand and actualize this Tathagata's true meaning. Again, good evening, everyone. Welcome. It's really wonderful to be here together with Sangha. And just to have this time and place together. It's always a special moment here in the Zendo. So tonight I wanted to open with some questions, and as students of this precious life of Zen, really just of being human, we begin to face questions of what we need to do to live more skillfully. We may ask, how can we let go of judgments, self-judgments, and live in this present moment? Can we see this moment as sacred, accepting ourselves and others as they are, accepting and letting go of our past? If we're both one and many, perfect and complete, revealing right here, right now, one breath at a time, then how do we live our lives from that place of perfect and complete? How do we mature to seeing things as they truly are? What are we waiting for? So our practice, our vehicle is, first of all, our daily zazen. Sitting nobly with dignity, we experience the truth of this moment. Nobility is defined as a quality of mind or character that commands excellence. Sitting nobly, we become intimate with the current moment, its possibility. In this way, we recognize that we are not alone, that we are all dependent on each other, interdependent. We're prepared to see the truth of this moment in whatever it reveals, and only then can we respond in a skillful way. Sitting with dignity, we are in a sense dignitaries in Zazen, knowing simply this now. When we gassho to each other, we bring the left and right hands together as an outward gesture of heart and mind working together to recognize, to express our true nature. We all have our unique configurations of muscles and bones, all shapes and sizes. But we all adopt an upright posture with a positioning of the hands that is in tune with the flow of our breath, with mindful energy that is both universal and yet deeply personal. When distractions, opinions, judgments, or thoughts arise, we notice and return. Sounds are simply the voices of Buddha, sensations, the touch of Buddha, thoughts, the mumbles of a Buddha, flavors, the taste of Buddha, sights, the vision of a Buddha, heat or cold, emanations of Buddha. These things don't become a problem or a distraction until we grab hold of them, label them, until we cross-reference them with our memories and add our opinions, weaving them into our stories. Can we manifest kindness toward all sensory experience? Acceptance, even love and gratitude, applying equally to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, beyond judgments and preferences. Your seat is supporting your weight, and the earth is ever drawing you towards its heart. Our memories are only reflections of a Buddha. As Chinese poet Xu Shi wrote following an experience of deep insight, "All night long I hear 100,000 scriptures in the sound of the mountain stream." So all those distractions and judgments are transformed once you realize they are manifestations of a Buddha, and you realize you are nothing but Buddha. And the only sensible thing to do is to accept your place in the world of Buddhas, free from rejection, in perfect alignment with our four great vows, vowing to love all beings, to abandon delusion, to master the truth, and to follow the Buddha way. We begin to fulfill all these four vows by living and breathing in the moment. The movement of breath from one self to another self, all one. With each breath, we are intimately entwined with all of life, all the planet. Our exhalation is an offering to all life that is green, and the favor is returned in the oxygen we receive back. Step outside of this moment, and we are living in the past, the place where the last thing we experienced is the one that our mind dwells on, or else in the imaginary future, unborn and vaporous. But if we listen for the voice of a Buddha in the current moment, we allow ourselves the freedom of choosing to experience what is actually happening now, opening up the possibility of choosing wisely, of using our discernment to see clearly, and to squash old habitual ways of reaction. In this way, we naturally do our best to make of our life a worthy expression. Clear aspiration guides our actions without striving or sweating the results. Zen teacher Shozan Jack Hobner offers that an artist can't strive to make art any more than a monk can strive for enlightenment. The important thing is to do honest work and leave the rest to fate, the muse, the Dharma. You can't control the outcome. You can't make things right. Whether you're a poet, a priest, or a plumber, all you can do is give yourself completely to the work. Let it speak for itself. If we fail to recognize our interdependence, our interbeing, we become addicted to the self. Zen teacher Steve Kanji Rule, in his book Appalachian Zen, writes that the most tenacious addiction is to the concept of self. Nothing, not whiskey, heroin, nicotine, or sex, can match the seductive, alluring, habituating power of ego. Think of Zen this way. It is a rehab for ego addicts, for self-aholics, a means for getting clean and sober. Or think of it this way. Zen is jailbreak, a method for busting free of the me obsession. Or think of it this way. Zen accomplishes for each person who practices it a type of Copernican revolution. Each of us ceases to be the center of his or her own individual cosmos. Zen training also helps dispel attachment to the illusion of yesterday or tomorrow, an illusion tugging at us so forcefully that we squander the only life endowed to us, the life unfolding in this perishable, irrecoverable flicker of time. This miraculous split second of breath and heartbeat. Zen training snaps the cognitive abstractions. It shouts, look, a cup of tea is a cup of tea. Really, reality, taste it. Zen training diminishes craving, the incessant yearning that makes us rattled and leaves us perpetually unfulfilled and nagged by desires. Zen teaches delight, delight in letting go of our thousand little Velcro hooks, delight in letting go of each rich, ephemeral moment in this world of flux and ceaseless permutation. Zen nourishes ethical life. This training can be thought of as a way of finding a path to true maturity. A sustained sitting practice allows us to begin to unwind a lifetime of stories. Stories that serve as a protective barrier between the ego or self-image and what is actually true. And I think that Zen meditation and modern psychological methods have some overlap in the kinds of issues they can address. When we experience some sort of trauma, and let's face it, we all have to various degrees, we develop certain unskillful behaviors or responses to that situation, and also ones that have any relationship or similarity to that traumatic event. We develop inappropriate patterns of behavior that some part of us thinks will protect us. And so we tend to reenact certain patterns when we get into situations that trigger us, what are often called fight, flight, or freeze reactions. These compulsions to fight or flee are not necessarily physical, though they often present physical symptoms, such as tightness or pain, but also mental or emotional stress and repetitive thought patterns. They are reactions to stories we've developed in response to earlier traumas and misfortunes. And deep meditative work tends to bring out the same sorts of things that psychotherapy does. And without some guidance, it can be quite a daunting task for an individual to cope, to understand, and to deal with the underlying and deeply buried issues. Charlotte Jokobek wrote deeply about this, and she emphasized that practice is largely the slow, patient unwinding of this unconscious structure. She called it our personal koan. And we do it by noticing our stories, noticing the physical manifestation or contraction in our body and staying with it. She counsels that we should observe rather than identify with these stories. And she stresses that trustworthy relationships are key to our practice and our recovery. She teaches that we meet our fear in small, digestible moments with kindness over time. Jokobek does not say trauma should just be accepted or let go. Instead, she says that we do not force ourselves. We do not expect the patterns to vanish. We learn to live with more freedom around them, and we heal the world by healing ourselves. By exercising gentle awareness in a setting of safety without inward or external pressures. Joko's framing is different from standard therapy. She doesn't treat this personal koan as a disorder, but as a lived existential pattern, a structure of habit, fear, and identity that shapes how we experience life. The personal koan is not a clinical diagnosis, but more like a personal lens, a way of seeing recurring suffering and habitual patterns, often rooted in early life or trauma, but encountered in everyday reality. As we develop insight into these patterns, we begin to unlock their misdirected energy and transform them through persistent observation and skillful effort. In coming to see these patterns in the light of healthy relationships, we mature. We become adults, true individuals. Zen teacher and poet Norman Fisher says, "Spiritual practice is, in effect, the practice of maturing, and that true maturity can never exist self-contained. Rather, it is relational, that we co-create each moment with those we come into contact with. The only way we can truly mature is in our expanding our ability to know and to love others. We do this through coming together, listening, being persistent, and developing warm-hearted, trusting relationships with others. In Zen practice, we make a commitment to meditation and take vows to effect a personal transformation." Quoting again from Appalachian Zen. In the Jukai ceremony, students formally become Zen Buddhists, vowing to live by 10 precepts. They vow to affirm life and not to kill. They vow to be giving and not to steal. They vow to honor the body, not misusing sexuality. They vow to manifest truth and not to lie. They vow to proceed with clarity, not befogging the mind. They vow to see perfection in others. They vow to realize that self and other are one. They vow to be generous and not to withhold. They vow to work for harmony. They vow to honor all creatures. Zen training, if pursued doggedly, can produce human beings whose minds glow with natural sanity, empathetic people, people hospitable to life, unsinkable people who are not afraid, clear, focused, alert, and balanced. In short, Buddhas. Brule's book speaks of growing up in a backwards town in the Appalachian Mountains. I didn't realize when I first picked it up that it was a memoir, but it turns out that this form of writing also reveals a deep teaching regarding impermanence and how we can live skillful lives as guided by Zen practice. The author speaks of his sister Sherry, who's plagued by schizophrenia and who eventually ends her own life after years of torturous and fearful episodes of perceiving demons and hearing voices. And yet, in his telling, her kindness and care for others over the years returns as a touchstone for him in the aftermath of her death. And he wonders if the teachings of the Buddha could have alleviated some of her pain and maybe saved her life. He writes, "How to restore in language the life of a person who refused that life, who said yes with less and less conviction, then finally said no. How to convey the gifts she bestowed, the tangible ones, candles and sachets formed lovingly by Sherry's own hand. Her letters written on thick rag paper, marbled pink and saffron, paper she'd made laboriously herself. Ginger snaps, baked from ginger she'd dried and ground. A fading Christmas tree ornament, memento from our childhood, rescued by Sherry and boxed with ribbons. Each spring, she assembled May baskets of cut daffodils, iris, and tulips, and she gave them as gifts to elderly neighbors. In fall, she gave them scarlet carnations. That summer, before Sherry killed herself, the trailer park blistered in a heat wave. She walked from door to sizzling door of each trailer, carrying her picnic cooler, a carton of vanilla ice cream, a scoop, and a box of wafer cones, surprising each shrunken old widow or desiccated old man living alone with an impromptu treat to cool and cheer and refresh them. "I thought you might like this," she announced, and she lingered to chat, relieving their loneliness. And of course, that was her true gift to them, her companionship on that hot day. So many gifts. The Bodhisattva's vow is one of altruism, and it requires us to live with kindness, energy, and responsibility. Responsibility derives from the Greek word meaning to respond, to offer, or pledge. So when you hear the call of the moment, you roll up your sleeves and do what is required. We let go of our preferences and habits and give ourselves to each situation with trust. And through experience, we begin to appreciate the uniqueness, the gift of each situation. Mature people have the strength of resolve, but remain flexible, open, and sensitive to life. They are not aloof, distant, or stuck. They recognize their own limitations without self-blame. They know that to listen deeply is to show respect, and that persistence blossoms into trust. With maturity, we become trusting and trustworthy, and we keep showing up. All of the components of maturity require serious attentiveness, which we develop in meditation. We discover our true selves and mutuality with other good-hearted people in our lives. We are constantly creating each other. This is our gift and our responsibility. The slow, patient unwinding of the unconscious structures of self proceeds through the power of presence and persistent effort, guided by intention and vow, and brings us to a silent metamorphosis. Buddhas in process.